Good morning.
I think I know somebody at every single table here today. I will still introduce myself for those of you who don't know me. I am Dr. Christopher Schamber. I'm a general internist at Sheridan Memorial Hospital and now practice at the primary care clinic downtown. I also do hospital medicine up at the hospital as well. I've been giving these talks now for a couple of years, 3 years maybe. 4 years? Has it been 4 years? And it's gone well so far. I'm still learning how to use the mic, so again, holler at me if you have trouble hearing. And this talk was sort of requested, I think, by a handful of people, at least to talk about some respiratory diseases. So I'll just go through, hopefully everybody has some paper beside them that they can look at and review. I'm happy for any questions as we're talking, or you can wait until the end. And let me know if there's anything else you need. Talk slower, talk faster, talk louder, anything like that. Are you hearing me okay over there? Is it coming through?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. All right, so the first disease I want to talk about is COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Pulmonary is a fancy word for lung. COPD is, I think, reasonably common in this country, and a lot of people have probably heard about it, have dealt with it personally, or have family members that have this lung disease. There are two types, emphysema and chronic bronchitis. The differences aren't really that important, but you might hear those two terms instead of COPD. It's a disease in which the lung tissue is damaged, or the airways that go to the lung tissue are damaged. Tobacco smoke is the most common cause, but other exposures to certain dusts, for example, coal dust, silica dust, there are some mines in different parts of the country with silica, and then even chronic dust exposure from farmers, for example, can cause chronic lung disease. Alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency is a rare genetic disorder that is contributed to liver disease and lung disease. It's uncommon, but it happens. That disease is specifically treatable. Symptoms of COPD, shortness of breath in many different forms. It can happen at rest or when someone is active. Cough is common, and typically people cough up phlegm, or we call it sputum. Tightness or heaviness in the chest. COPD tends to flare. We call that exacerbation. And that looks like just worse symptoms, a worse cough. It's the phlegm is thicker. You have more shortness of breath, more chest tightness. The same things that cause COPD can cause it to flare. So smoking, or recently we've had a lot of smoke from fires in Canada. I've had a lot of patients have worse breathing because of that smoke that comes down. Allergies in the air when the pollen's flying. Sometimes people are really sensitive to perfumes or other really strong smells that can kick it into gear. And there are certain medications as well. Cold air also, interestingly, is one that can really anger the lungs in someone that has COPD. Is everybody still hearing me okay? Okay. And treatment usually requires some form of steroids, usually a pill, and then an antibiotic as well. Sometimes people are sick enough that they need to be hospitalized and put on ventilator, but a lot of times we can treat them through the clinics. So treatment, smoking, it absolutely has to stop. So smoking and oxygen, if somebody needs it, are the only two things that prolong life in someone with COPD. Continuing to smoke certainly is something that will make it go a lot quicker and make it worse. Inhalers, typically on a regular basis, and short-acting inhalers that use as needed to help symptoms. And then we typically follow our patients with COPD at least a couple of times a year, if not more. Someone needs to be seen for sure if they have worsening symptoms, worsening shortness of breath, worsening cough. Their sputum is a lot thicker. Those are all indications to get seen either at the hospital, you know, in the emergency department, at the urgent care, or at the clinic. Good morning. Okay, asthma is another disease that's very similar to COPD. It typically happens in younger folks. Even in you know, before 5 years old, people can get asthma. It acts similarly in ways, certainly not caused by smoking, but smoking can make it worse. It's a genetic condition caused by many different sort of genes. Basically, just someone's genetic makeup puts them at risk for asthma. In younger folks, it can be really, really dangerous and deadly, and quite scary, to be fair. So it's, in some respects, it's quite a bit scarier than COPD. In older folks, it acts about the same as COPD. I won't go too much more in depth on asthma, because a lot of the symptoms and the triggers and the flares really look very similar. Okay, pneumonia. Has anyone in the audience had pneumonia before? Raise your hand. Handful. Yeah. So probably one person at every table, it looks like. So pneumonia is just an infection in the lungs caused by lots of different things. It's not a specific bug. So lots of bacteria, lots of viruses, even fungus, which I won't really talk about here. There are some non-infectious pneumonias that we also won't talk about here. Influenza or flu can cause pneumonia. COVID, right, we're still sort of seeing it, and of course we had that handful of years where it was bad, that causes pneumonia. So again, pneumonia is just a term that means infection in the lung caused by any number of different bugs. Most of the time it occurs randomly, so anybody can get it. Certainly people that have chronic lung disease like COPD, or somebody that's on chemotherapy, or somebody that has a depressed immune system can be more prone to getting pneumonia. Certain people that have abnormal lungs from diseases like cystic fibrosis, which is something that onsets when someone is younger. Even as an older person, if you had a lot of infections as a kid, that can make your lungs prone to getting pneumonia. And then there are other factors that we look at if somebody has ongoing or recurrent pneumonia, like Lisa talked about, that we can discuss in office. Symptoms, cough, shortness of breath, chest pain sometimes, depending on where the pneumonia is at and how big it is. Fevers and chills and shaking. Symptoms that happen with lots of different infections, with urinary infections and pneumonias and COVID and flu. Just our generic sort of infectious type symptoms. Treatment consists of antibiotics most of the time. I would say there's rare instances in which we don't need antibiotics. If it's a viral pneumonia for influenza, for example, we treat with a specific medication for flu. We now have treatments for COVID. And so depending on the bug, there are some specific treatments. Sometimes there's not specific treatments. Oxygen, if it's needed, sometimes we need to give people inhalers to help them cough up the gunk out of their lungs. Pneumonia can cause people to be dehydrated rather quickly, and that causes its own problems. So drinking lots of fluids or getting IV fluids in the vein, if needed, is a treatment as well. In terms of prevention, for the bugs that we have a vaccine against, flu is an example. There's a couple of different bacteria that we have routine vaccines for. COVID, those are probably the three main. That's the only way to really truly prevent or decrease the risk of certain types of pneumonia. Now, it doesn't prevent all types of pneumonia. And the ones against specifically the pneumonia vaccine, which you may have heard about during your annual exams, that's geared at the bacteria that most commonly causes pneumonia in this country. Okay, everybody still hear me okay?
Yeah.
Any questions yet?
Okay. Now, as long as you're on pneumonia, what's the difference between pneumonia and what's referred to as walking pneumonia?
Okay, the question was, what's the difference between pneumonia and walking pneumonia? Walking pneumonia is just a pneumonia that's not bad enough to put you down and out or put you in the hospital. So somebody feels crummy, but they're still probably out walking around, able to do things. Yeah. Yeah. The new vaccine. Yeah. It's so I would say it's still new, not necessary for most people, at least at the current time. There's a few people, particularly people that are at risk for getting infections. So it's something you definitely should talk to your doctor about. It just came out a couple of months ago, I think. Yeah. And it's all over. There must be ads all over the place because I get asked about it multiple times a day. Yeah. But thank you for bringing that up. That is a new one out, though. RSV is a virus that we see more frequently, I'd say, in young kids, but it's a really common virus that's all around. It causes common colds, it can cause pneumonia, and other things. What was that? It depends on each different person. So that's why I say it's important to talk to your doctor about that and ask him. Okay. Any other questions on that topic? So the comment was that there are some interactions potentially with the RSV vaccine and to look at medication list. The specific medication was prednisone. The issue there is that prednisone depresses your immune system. So any vaccine, the way all types of vaccines work is stimulating the immune system so that when your body encounters that bug again, that it can fight it off. If you're on prednisone and it's depressing the immune system, you might not have as good of a response to the vaccine. So the risk is not having as good of a vaccine response, if that makes sense. Not that you will have a bad reaction per se, but that you just won't get a good enough response. Yeah. Okay, did that answer your question? Okay. Sure, yeah. That sounds appropriate. Yeah. Okay, lung cancer. Most lung cancers are related to smoking. Asbestos is another form of cancer. It's becoming less common associated with, mesothelioma. I misspoke. Mesothelioma is a cancer that is less common and decreasing associated with asbestos exposure. Asbestos is less frequent today, but used to be associated with various plumbing materials, brake pads, naval ships, older naval ships. It was common, so that's another type of lung cancer. And then other chemicals, again, coal is associated with lung cancer. Symptoms, there may not be any symptoms. And then you can get all of the other symptoms that we've talked about so far: cough, shortness of breath, chest pain. And then if the cancer is spread to somewhere, so let's say bone, it can cause pain in that specific area where it's spread. Weight loss can be common depending on the stage in which the cancer is found. We do have lung cancer screening for certain individuals, so you have to be between the ages of 50 and 80 and have to have smoked at least a pack a day for 20 years or more and quit in the 15 years prior to when we would screen. And that, it looks like a low-dose CT or CAT scan every year for a couple of years, depending on what is found on the CAT scan. That's something we will bring up depending on someone's smoking status. If you have questions or concerns about that, you should talk to your doctor. But we do have that availability out there, similar to mammogram screening for breast cancer, right? There are specific evaluations for people that have been exposed to coal dust. That program is called NOWCAP, and the Black Lung Clinic, and it's specific to people who have worked in or around coal mines. They get free screenings with certain physical exams and chest x-rays. I think the only place, or one of only a few places in the state, is in Sheridan. given that we have so many sort of coal mines within this region up here. Okay, pulmonary embolism. That is a blood clot in the lungs. It's reasonably common. Sometimes happens without any risk factors. Other times happens because of a certain few set of diseases or other activities that put someone at risk. Cancer is one of those that puts someone at increased risk of different types of clots. Leg injuries, so if you bump your leg into a table really hard and get a big bruise and swollen leg, that can lead to blood clots. Any recent surgery that causes you to be laid up for a while, you know, you're on the couch recouping for a week or two, not moving much. Any long travel, so a long plane ride for 8 hours, not moving much, a long car ride, more than 3 or 4 hours at a time sitting without moving can increase the risk of blood clots in the legs and the lungs. And then, of course, blood clotting disorders. A lot of times, though, we don't know someone has these until they get their first blood clot. Treatment includes blood thinning medications, and occasionally you have to have a procedure. I would say that's rare, and that's typically if somebody has a blood clot and they're dying at that moment, they go in for an emergency procedure. So it's not very common. Okay, questions on lung cancer or blood clots in the lungs? Still hear me back there? Okay. Pulmonary edema is not a disease, but it's something that sort of happens in the lungs, and I'll explain what I mean there. Pulmonary edema is fluid in the lungs, and it happens for a number of different reasons, but typically it's related to the heart not working right, something we call heart failure. The heart is a fancy pump, and if pumps don't work, they back up fluid, right? So if your sump pump isn't working, fluid's gonna build up in your basement, right? If your heart's not pumping right, fluid's gonna build up into the lungs, and that creates difficulties breathing. It's hard to breathe through water without an oxygen tank, right? So again, most commonly related to heart failure. Occasionally, if someone's really sick from a number of different things and they have really bad inflammation across the body, it can lead to fluid dumping into the lungs. I would say that's really rare. Symptoms, again, shortness of breath, cough, heavy chest, chest pain as well. Treatment, we first need to know what caused the problem. Again, most of the time it's heart, and most of the time the treatment is diuretics, or what most people know as water pills. Make you pee out extra fluid, and with time that sort of pulls the extra fluid out of the lungs and makes it easier to breathe. And then of course we treat whatever the cause is, the underlying heart disease, as best as we can.
Dr. Schaefer,
yes.
For people that are living and with heart failure,
yeah. So the question is, with heart failure or any of these lung diseases, if there are certain types of heart or lung therapy that can be beneficial, the answer is yes. People have to be sort of on the severe end of the spectrum. A lot of hospitalizations or really bad disease by a number of different sort of indicators. And then insurance, of course, plays a role in everything that we do. So people have to meet certain criteria with, again, things like hospitalizations and severity of disease to qualify for those therapies. We do have both cardiac rehab, which is geared towards people with heart failure or heart attacks, and pulmonary rehab for people that have chronic lung disease like COPD or even lung cancer.
And they would work with their primary care doctors, and that's all through the hospital?
That's all through the hospital, yes.
Yeah. Someone was asking about that.
Yeah. Did everybody hear that answer? All right, we should talk about oxygen as well, safe oxygen use. I won't go through all of these items. I think the number one safe oxygen use sort of no-no is don't smoke around oxygen. That's one of the few things you need to have a fire is oxygen, right? So you have a little bit of hair or skin or the cigarette itself and a big oxygen tank, you have lots of stuff to make a good fire on your skin. It's no good. That goes also for any sort of heat. So cooking in the stove, big no-no. Anything that's sort of, that's hot and could combust and cause flames, you don't want to be around when you're using oxygen. Even electrical appliances that have the potential to spark could cause a fire, so being careful in those situations. You have to be careful with the type of bedding you have. You have to be careful with things like petroleum jelly, like Vaseline, for example, because that's a petroleum product and that can burn as well. So having to keep all of these things separated, just like you would if you were around a campfire, for example. You wouldn't go throw an oxygen bottle on it, right? You would be careful about where it's at. You have to be careful the same way with oxygen use. And there are a few others. So don't use alcohol-based hand sanitizers. Don't oil the oxygen unit. That is something I didn't necessarily know about. But again, trying to keep all of the things away from the oxygen that could be bad if they connect and start a fire together. Okay, that is all I have prepared. There are a bunch of different resources from various places at the bottom of the paper you have. What questions can I answer? Yes, sir. I think you and I talked about this specifically, didn't we? Are you holding me to the fire here? The answer is it depends. Studies with aspirin used to prevent heart attacks and strokes have occurred. The benefit has been shown in people that have already had a first heart attack and stroke. So those people for sure, unless there's a reason not to have an aspirin, so if they have bleeding issues or potentially clotting issues, aspirin, the issue you're talking about came out a year or two ago as a recommendation to not, as a routine or standard thing, if you're over 65, just go pick up an aspirin and take it every day because it's good for your heart. That's not a good idea. If someone's at risk for a heart attack, let's say they have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, they smoke, they have diabetes, probably should discuss with your provider starting an aspirin. But if somebody is healthy and doesn't have all those things, I think an aspirin is more risky than it is helpful. So both, I gave you both answers, plus and minus. Yes. Okay, and I can link this to lung disease for you. So dysphagia, the question was, how do you, what is dysphagia and how do you work it up and look into it? Dysphagia just means difficulty swallowing. A lot of different causes, all the way from the lips down to the bottom of the stomach. If someone has problems swallowing, then they can aspirate stuff, not swallow into their esophagus and down to the stomach, but rather have food and stuff go into their windpipe, and that can cause pneumonia in and of itself. Workup is, it kind of depends on the situation, a couple of things. Some type of swallowing study, there's a bunch of different types depending on what the specific situation. So sometimes swallowing barium, which is a substance that lights up on chest x-rays. Speech therapists also do a fancy type of video swallow study where they have cameras and they sort of look at various structures inside the mouth and the throat while someone's swallowing. That's the start of the workup. And then treatment is varying really depending on what the cause is. There's lots of different treatment options depending on all the factors that are playing a role. Yeah, so it kind of depends on if it's from your stomach or if it's from your lungs. Most of the time that stuff is from the lungs. And then, a lot of people just cough it up and then swallow it back down in their stomach, right? And that can have issues. That also depends on what's causing the phlegm. Inhalers can help with that situation. The decongestants, like the Mucinex, I would say plus minus or 50-50, however you want to say that. They work for some people and they don't work for other people. Did that answer? I know, still kind of a vague question. There's a whole lot of what ifs depending on each person's situation. Other questions?
What about getting ready for the winter?
Yeah.
Any advice?
So the question was how to get ready for winter. So the things that, you know, we think about, we used to call it the flu season, right? That we probably should call it flu and COVID season or respiratory season, whatever you, all the number of other things that cause issues. The old wives' tale, if you will, about cold causing pneumonia and cold causing infections is not true. But what it does do is push people inside and in closer proximity to people. So you're much more likely to pass on a bug or get a bug if somebody's coughing in the same room versus if you're out in Whitney Commons running around. So in preparation for that, taking vaccines if you're due for certain vaccines and you're not at risk for a bad complication or you haven't had a complication of the vaccines, taking those on a regular basis. Again, which ones are specific to you, it's different. Flu vaccines are every year. COVID vaccines, the new recommendations are over 65 and those people that have depressed immune systems twice a year, all others once a year. I'm telling people, especially right now, if you are going to get those shots, wait until October so you get a good amount of protection, you know, November, December, January. The pneumonia vaccine isn't as important to give in that same time period. After 65, there's a couple of different considerations though. After 65, there's two different shots and then you're vaccinated for life. They're typically separated by a year. So you don't have to get those every year once you've gotten your initial shots. And then I think measures, so I think things we learned during COVID, masks can help me limit spreading of my disease to someone else. Hand washing works. And so those are a few things that I think if you're sick and helping to decrease the spread to other people is a good thing. It's something that I personally hadn't done before when I had a regular cold. But if I have a cold and I have to be out in the community, I'll be wearing a mask and I'm gonna be more diligent washing my hands. So those I think are a couple of standard measures, regardless of whether we're talking bacteria or flu or COVID or anything else. RSV are good things to help prevent spreading from yourself to someone else. Yes? Spread everything, yeah. So the question was, as someone who is frequently around young kiddos, you say kindergarten through second, right? And they carry lots of bugs. They're always sniveling little kids, right? How do you protect yourself? Yeah, so the vaccines, like I talked about, hand washing, if they're sick, keeping them home, wearing masks, hand washing, if you can, yeah. Sometimes it's hard to prevent those things. Not a great answer, I know. Yes, ma'am. Okay, so did I see a hand come up at that table? Who else? Anybody else?
Did you have a question?
Yes. So there are, for the pneumonia vaccine, which is a vaccine specific to the most common bacteria that causes pneumonia, depending on the situation, typically there's two vaccine doses. They're both a little bit different, and they're separated a year apart. So after 65, it's typically two shots separated by a year, and then you're done for the pneumonia shots. No, for the pneumonia vaccine, for life. Flu every year, COVID twice a year. What was that? So the question was why twice a year on COVID? So all the vaccines that are out today, they sort of build up and are offer great protection for between 3 and 6 months. Depending on the symptom and if we're talking about severe disease or death or hospitalization. And so that effectiveness starts to trail off at between 3 and 6 months. And so that's why the twice a year for people that are older or people that have a depressed immune systems. Most of them you can give at the same time. There's a few considerations. Most of the routine vaccines, no problem. There's some specific travel vaccines for people that are going to places like Africa and South America that we have considerations on giving at separate times. But all the regular vaccines you can give together. Yeah, usually not needed. If you did get them separated for some reason and you got one vaccine and then you need to get another, and if you're not getting them at the same time, for whatever reason, they'll typically recommend separating it by, 1 to 2 months. Yeah. But you don't need to do that.
Yes.
So the question, do I use it or should you use it? Yeah, I guess technically you're right. She asked if sleep apnea was a respiratory condition. Yes, it's upper respiratory, so it involves not the lungs, except it does. I'll explain that part of it. It involves the upper airway, so the upper airway closing in obstructive sleep apnea, and that keeps someone from breathing. Their body has to wake themselves up enough so that they open their airway and can breathe again. And that's problematic because sleep is when our body and our brain rests and repairs. And so if you're not sleeping well, you're not repairing well, and so a lot of things go haywire. Lack of sleep can cause pain, certainly make pain worse. It can make your brain not function well. Sometimes people appear to have dementia because they have such poor sleep from sleep apnea. And there's a whole lot of other things. Where it relates to the lungs is that the oxygen can drop to more or less of a degree, depending on how severe the obstruction in the airway is. And that can cause its own problems in the blood and the heart. How long have you been on it?
Almost a year.
A year and a half. I would say most people tolerate CPAP eventually. Probably 50% have no problem off the bat. The other 50% have a problem, and a good majority of those get used to it. Some people never get used to it, but they feel so much better on it that they work through it. So some people never can tolerate it. Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, so it's also not. Nothing in medicine is absolute, and the risks associated with sleep apnea, I think, sometimes can be overstated. And the treatment of sleep apnea can improve some of the things that are associated with it, but don't always, if that makes sense. So it's not this absolute, like you have sleep apnea, you will die from a heart attack, and if you get CPAP treatment, you're going to not die. It's not like that. Yeah. There is something called a hypoglossal nerve simulator. Inspire is one of the brands. And they seem to work well, but they're expensive. So hasn't caught on with the insurances yet. Yeah. Yeah. You're welcome. But a year and a half, though. That's my final answer.
All right, well, bless you.
Yes. So her comment was that the BiPAP is a treatment in addition to CPAP. So very similar treatments, very specific considerations for somebody that requires BiPAP though. Most often we don't use it for CPAP or sleep apnea, we use it for other respiratory diseases actually. BiPAP acts like a ventilator, which is pushing air in and out. So lots of different things. People like Stephen Hawking had a BiPAP type machine through a tracheostomy, right, a ventilator, because their respiratory muscles didn't work, right, to help them breathe. So there's different considerations. There's some types of sleep apnea, not obstructive sleep apnea, that require BiPAP or other special sort of units that keep a set rate and a volume of air. But for the standard sleep apnea, not BiPAP. There's other specific considerations though. Yes. So the question was, if you have fluid in or around your lungs or heart, can you drain it off? So yes, we talked about water pills. Were you here for that? And then there are procedures. If the fluid is around the lungs or around the heart, there are procedures that you stick a needle in that area and drain it off. Yes. Yeah. What else? Yes, ma'am. Sure.
Okay. Do you
The question was, do I think masks work for all things? I think they work. There's lots of considerations there. I think the best benefit is for preventing me from spreading something to someone else. Yeah, I mean, if it's worn well, right, of course. The other considerations are surgical type masks, the paper type masks that you see in the hospital, those are better than the cloth masks that a lot of us wear out in the community. Once something gets soiled and wet, it's not gonna work as well. The other thing is if I cough on you and you have a mask and it gets on the outside of the mask and then you touch your mask and then you take it off and then right, washing the hands and all that kind of stuff. So there's all these considerations. So I think a mask worn properly, changed frequently, in addition to things like hand washing, which we did all these things sort of at the same time, right? Those things help. Yeah. So, and COVID specifically lived, there are studies that looked at isolating it from clothes, you know, porous stuff versus like a metal railing that's not porous or a table like that. It lived for days and days on hard surfaces and it died pretty quickly when it got on clothes, for example. Yeah. Yeah, or a tissue. The question on the last question was, if somebody's coughing, how should they cough? I think a lot of us tend to turn around backwards, which is probably not a great idea because it's going to spew it that way. Shouldn't cough without covering your mouth. Some way to cover your mouth to keep it from going forward. Yeah, I mean, if you're going to cough into your hand, that's fine, but you should wash it afterwards. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, thank you all. Thank you. Yeah.